Well, good morning. It's special to be back here with you all. Yeah, we missed a number of Sundays, and then last Sunday when we were back, we were over there. But we did come over here just enough to see the benches and appreciate them. So that's special, and special to be back. So this morning, I want us to look at some landmark events from the life of Saul and think about how Saul started off well and how he lost his way. Saul did start off well, but he ended up in a bad place. And I think there was a time or two when he knew it. One of those times was when David came out of the cave with that scrap of robe that he had cut off of Saul. And David said, you know, if I was your enemy, would I have done this? And it says that when David had finished speaking these words to Saul, that Saul said, is this your voice, my son David? And Saul lifted up his voice and wept. And why was he weeping? And I think he was weeping because the scales had come off his eyes and he realized what kind of person he really was here. He said to David, you are more righteous than I, for you have rewarded me with good, whereas I have rewarded you with evil. And you have shown this day how you have dealt well with me. For when the Lord delivered me into your hand, you did not kill me. And I think Saul could see himself in a way he hadn't seen himself before. And I think he was having one of those, how did I get here kind of moments. So how did he ever end up in such a state? We're going to talk about what happened to him. But the point I want us to get up here at the beginning is it is possible to start off in a good direction, to start off well, and to end up very far from where we ought to be. So on our Western trip, while we were out in Wisconsin a few weeks back, we spent a couple of days with Colleen's sister and her husband and family. And so we got there on a Sunday evening, stayed there through Tuesday morning sometime, Tuesday afternoon. And we actually stayed in an Airbnb 15 minutes away for the night. So there was a fair amount of driving back and forth. This is not familiar territory for me. But we made the drive a number of times. And on Tuesday morning, the last morning we were there in Wisconsin, Colleen and I were driving back to the house where my sister-in-law's place. And the kids were not with us. They had stayed there overnight with their cousins. And so we were driving back, and we kept driving and kept driving. You kind of know how this story is going to go. After a while, because Colleen and I were having a deep and meaningful conversation. I don't remember what it was about. After a while, Colleen said, where are we? And I looked around and asked the same question. I had no idea where we were. I mean, well, this is not how you get to where we were planning on going. And so if I got out the GPS. This is the one time I hadn't used it because I didn't need it, really. And I turned it on, realized here, you know, when we had left the house, we were 15 minutes away. We had started off in the right direction, but now we were 30 minutes away, like even farther from when we started. And I don't know how long it took us to get back to where we were intending to be in the first place. But I had taken a wrong turn at some point. I think I went south instead of north or vice versa. And we were far from where I had intended to be. It was no big deal. It was a little embarrassing, but it was okay. And the point is, basically, if we're not watchful, the same thing can happen to us spiritually and in our walk with God. We can end up pretty far from where we want to be. So let's look at a handful of scenes from Saul's life and watch his drift and be reminded of how this can happen. What we'll do is first we'll be looking at scenes. This is all in 1 Samuel. We'll be looking at a few scenes in chapters 9 through 11. So obviously I'm not reading those chapters. I'll just be pointing out a few things and moving on. So this will probably work best if you have your Bibles open and can kind of follow along. So that'll be the first part. We'll talk about how Saul started off pretty well, actually. Had some good things. Then in chapters 13 and 14, we'll look at how he went off course. And we won't be studying the whole history of Saul's life, just a number of scenes. And then after that, we'll talk about what happened and what we need to watch out for in ourselves. So, I don't think Saul was ever a David, but he definitely had some positive traits to start with. And the first scene I'll take you to is in 1 Samuel chapter 9, verses 5 through 7. And here, maybe I'm making too big of a deal out of a little incident, but I think it's a positive one. Saul is traveling with his servant. They're searching for the lost donkeys, his dad's lost donkeys. It's interesting how God used them to get Saul to where he wanted him to be. You remember this story? They can't find them. And a lot of time has passed, and they're far from home, and Saul says, "We need to turn around and go back." And his servant says, "Wait, we're close to where the prophet stays. Why don't we go talk to him and see what he has to say?" And Saul says, "But I don't have anything to give the prophet. I don't have a gift." And his servant says, "But I have a little bit of silver." And then Saul says, "That's well said. Let's go do this. This is a good idea." And I just appreciate that little interaction there between Saul and his servant. Saul has one idea. Let's go back. His servant has an alternative idea. And Saul accepts it and says, "Good idea. Let's do this." So that's a good sign. Then later on in verse 21, when Samuel anoints or tells him, "You're the one," this is chapter 9, verse 21, "You're the one who's going to be the king of Israel." Okay, I'm paraphrasing, obviously. And Saul said, "Am I not a Benjamite of the smallest of the tribes of Israel, and my family the least of all the families of the tribe of Benjamin?" So Saul did not see himself as a hugely important person at this stage, and that's good. Okay, let's move on into chapter 10. Here at the coronation ceremony, you remember, they can't find him. They go through this process of choosing the man, and they can't find him then. It's kind of a funny scene. He's hiding in the luggage. He was not eager to be king. He was not power hungry. And I'll mark that as a point in his favor. I appreciate that. And at the end of this account, more importantly, at verse 27, after Saul's been crowned king, some rebels are not impressed. And they say, "How can this man save us? How can he save us?" And they despised him and brought him no presents. And it looks like Saul was aware of this, but in verse 27, you see that he held his peace and didn't try to set the record straight or to fix this. I think that was a sign of some meekness and some maturity. So some positive traits here in the life of Saul. And then if you go over to chapter 11 now. Okay, so we're looking at some of the good things that we can say about Saul to start with. And how he started off well. Okay, chapter 11, this is probably the most impressive moment from Saul's career. And this is the story of how the Ammonites came up against the city of Jabesh-Gilead. They had the city under siege, and the people of Jabesh-Gilead, you know, are about ready to cave, and they say, we will be your servants if you'll just make peace with us. And the Ammonites say, okay, there's one condition, and that is we have to put out all of your eyes, or I think the eyes of the men. And so, obviously, people of Jabesh-Gilead are not too excited about that offer. So they sent out messengers into Israel for help, and the news reached Saul. Now go down to verse 5. Do you see what Saul is doing when he finds out? He is following the herd out of the field. So even though he's been crowned king, his occupation is still farmer. I think that's kind of neat. And it says the Spirit of God came upon him. He was angry. He took charge of the situation. He called all the fighting men of Israel together. They attacked the Ammonites and brought about an impressive deliverance. And then, this is the most important moment, after that was all done and Saul has been confirmed as king. Actually, that happens in 13. But after this battle is over and Saul's victorious, then Saul's supporters say, let's go back. You remember those rebels who said, how can he save us? Let's go take care of them now. Let's go have them executed. And a calculating king might have gone along with a suggestion like this. I mean, strike while the iron is hot. These men are a problem. They're a threat to the throne, and they're going to be a problem going forward. Why not do this? Doesn't this make sense? But instead, in verse 13, Saul said, not a man shall be put to death this day, for today the Lord has accomplished salvation in Israel. And I love the insight, the vision that Saul has here. And by the way, I'm going to be talking about vision a fair amount this morning. And when I say vision, I don't mean someone having a grand idea. I'm talking about how we look at God and how we look at ourselves. But that's the most important kind of vision. And here, Saul's vision is excellent. He recognizes God's role in this victory. God is the deliverer. He did this. And he also recognizes his role and that he doesn't need to seize the opportunity to make himself king. I'm not going to make this day about me and my throne. The Lord is the one responsible for this victory, and this is bigger than me. And this is what every Christian needs to recognize. You know, we've got responsibility. We've got a role to play, but we're also part of something much bigger than ourselves. This was Saul's most David-like moment. And there in chapter 11, verse 13, today the Lord has accomplished salvation in Israel. And maybe we can remember kind of moments like this in our lives, points in our life when we felt fulfilled and like we were being used by God, and God looked really big and we looked really small, but we also felt like we were in a really good place. That's how it should be. So Saul started off well, but his vision got blurry. And now we're going to shift directions and look at chapters 13 and 14 and see how Saul got way off track. In chapter 12, Saul is confirmed as king. We're not going to look at that chapter. We're going to go on to chapter 13. And some years have passed, and we don't know how many years have passed. A lot of people say 3 to 5 years. We don't really know. Verse 1 of chapter 13 is, if you look in your Bibles, you'll probably see a footnote about it because it's a difficult to translate verse. So we don't really know how many years have passed. But the situation, Saul's situation, is not the same as it was back in chapter 11. In chapter 11, he was king on paper, but he was still leading the herd around. He was still a farmer. But by chapter 13, he's not a farmer anymore. He's a king with an army, and he's been confirmed as king. And people recognize his authority, and he's used it. He's been to war. He's been victorious. He's the most powerful man in Israel, and he has been for several years. So in chapter 13, the Philistines are on the march. They assemble a huge army. They are camped at Michmash. And Saul, this is a familiar story, but we're going to review it anyway. Saul has been commanded to wait for Samuel. This is an instruction that Samuel calls the commandment of the Lord. He needs to wait for Samuel. But while Saul is waiting, the army is melting. His people are scattering. And then finally, when Samuel doesn't show up, Saul goes ahead and offers the sacrifice himself. And there are two views. This was wrong. There are two views for why it was wrong, and I don't know which one's right. But the one view is that Saul was not authorized to make this kind of offering. Okay, that's one view. The other view is that Saul did not wait long enough for Samuel. Even though the 7 days were up, Saul was supposed to wait until Samuel arrived, and he didn't. So we're not going to go into which view is right. The point is that Saul disobeyed. And immediately, ironically, as soon as he's done doing this, Samuel shows up and asks, "What have you done?" And Saul said, "When I saw that the people were scattered from me and that you did not come within the days appointed," two excuses, "and that the Philistines gathered together at Michmash, then I said, the Philistines will now come down on me at Gilgal, and I have not made supplication to the Lord. Therefore, I felt compelled, and I offered a burnt offering." And I think the phrase, "I felt compelled," tells us that Saul knew he was deviating from instructions, from the ideal course. The army was scattering. You didn't come. And I hadn't appealed to God. And it sounds like his reasoning is, it's better for me to give God his offering, make sure God gets his offering, than for me to strictly follow orders. But Samuel says, "You have done foolishly and have not kept the commandment of the Lord." And I really don't like what this failure of Saul's tells us about his vision. I don't like this shift I see in Saul. Which is more important? Is it more important to follow God or to appeal to God? Which is more important, being used by God or getting God to do what we want? So I see a shift here in Saul's vision of himself and of God. And so that's the chapter 13. Saul disobeys God's instructions to suit his own timeline and his own logic. Let's go into chapter 14. Now, this is important. Chapter 14 picks up where chapter 13 left off. It's not switching to a new account. This is not a new story. It's chapter 13 continued. "Now, it happened one day that Jonathan, the son of Saul, said to the young man who bore his armor, "Come, let us go over to the Philistines' garrison that is on the other side." But he did not tell his father. And Saul was sitting in the outskirts of Gibeah under a pomegranate tree, which is in Migron. The people who were with him were about 600 men. Ahijah, the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, the Lord's priest in Shiloh, was wearing an ephod. But the people did not know that Jonathan had gone. Now, I want to make a few comments here. The author, the writer here, maybe it's Samuel, is not just telling a story. He's painting a picture, and he's doing a good job. He is painting a picture of who Saul is these days, and he's contrasting him with Jonathan. And the picture we get of Saul is a king sitting under a pomegranate tree waiting for something to happen. It might have been a pomegranate cave. It says, some translations say the pomegranate cave. Okay, tree or cave, Saul is waiting. And at this point, Saul only has 600 men left. So the Philistines have a massive army. Israel is in an embarrassing situation, hiding in caves, which Philistines seem to enjoy. Has there been a battle yet? Between chapter 13 and 14, there's not been a battle. Think about that for a second. There's not been a battle. You get the significance of this. In chapter 13, Saul ran out of time. He couldn't wait for Samuel anymore. He had to offer the sacrifice. But here he is in chapter 14, sitting under a pomegranate tree or in a cave. He liked caves. Waiting for something to happen. Meanwhile, Jonathan says to his armor bearer, let's go check on the Philistines. Maybe they need something from us. And the author goes out of his way to say, but he did not tell his father. Like the author is making a pretty clear point here. He did not tell his father. And the picture the writer is painting is that Saul doesn't have the kind of faith of Jonathan, and also Jonathan doesn't really trust his father to do the right thing in this situation. Now, you know the rest of the story well enough that I'm going to skip some of these next few verses. You know that while Saul is waiting, Jonathan and his armor bearer ask God for direction. They do, and then they get the green light, and they go on the attack, and God helps out. And there's this kind of amazing battle happens, and the Philistines start to crumble. Two men. Saul has 598. Two men do this. And let's go back to the camp of Saul now in verse 16. Drop down to verse 16. We're in 1 Samuel chapter 14, verse 16. Now the watchmen of Saul in Gibeah of Benjamin looked, and there was the multitude melting away. And they went here and there, as the Philistines are melting away. Then Saul said to the people who were with him, "Now call the roll and see who has gone from us." And when they had called the roll, surprisingly, Jonathan and his armor bearer were not there. How long do you think that roll call took? You got 600 men. How long did it take to get them all assembled and to find out which two people were missing? Next, verse 18, and Saul said to Ahijah, "Bring the ark of God here." For at that time, the Ark of God was with the children of Israel. Some manuscripts say, like the Septuagint would say, ephod here instead of ark. And it kind of makes more sense that he would have called for the ephod than for the ark to be carried over. But either way, Saul's about to ask for God's input. into this situation. That's what he's trying to do. And it's a good idea if he had stuck with it. But in verse 19, now it happened, while Saul talked to the priest, that the noise which was in the camp of the Philistines continued to increase. So Saul said to the priest, withdraw your hand. In other words, stop what you're doing. We don't have time for this anymore. Okay, cancel that. And we need to pause here and absorb this little lesson, or big lesson. Saul has time for some things, but not others, doesn't he? He doesn't have time to keep waiting for Samuel, but he does have time to wait under a pomegranate tree for the situation to become more favorable. He doesn't have time to wait for God's input here in chapter 14, but he does have time for a roll call. That's interesting. And we need to think about this, because we don't want to be like Saul. What we have time for and what we don't have time for, what we cancel, what we postpone, can say a lot about our spiritual maturity. Contrast this with David coming back to Ziklag and finding that the Amalekites have attacked and taken all the wives and children captive, and says David strengthened himself in the Lord, and David called for the ephod and sought the Lord's direction and asked, should we pursue them or not? So in a crisis even greater than Saul's, David took time for God's direction. And so I need to ask myself, am I more like David, or am I more like Saul in what I choose to make time for? Do I cut off God sometimes or hang up on him before he can speak into my life? And this goes back to the vision question. How do I fit into this picture? Am I here to be used by God, or am I here to make things happen? So the next thing that happens here in chapter 14 is they start to chase the pursuing the Philistines. Let's go on down to verse 24. 1 Samuel 14, verse 24, and the men of Israel were distressed that day, for Saul had placed the people under oath, saying, cursed is the man who eats any food until evening before I have taken vengeance on my enemies. So none of the people tasted food. Now, the point of this oath was to keep the army on the move. Let's not even stop to eat. We're just going to chase these Philistines until we've destroyed them all. And it's a bad idea. Yeah, just from a purely physical standpoint, this is a bad idea. You can't go hours on end maintaining a major physical effort without any fuel. You've got to have something. So it happens that honey is a pretty good option. Anyway, the people had to have been, they were staggering by the end of the day. But even besides the physical challenge here, I don't like this oath of Saul's for a number of reasons. First of all, it's a Saul measure and not a God measure. Saul had no direction from God to make this kind of demand, so it was totally his idea. And I don't like how Saul doesn't wait for God's direction, but then he does invoke the name of God to get the people to do what he wants. Something just feels out of whack with that. I don't like that it's harsh. There are other ways to encourage speed other than the threat of a curse. You know, maybe Saul should have made the offer now that he made later, whoever kills the most Philistines gets to marry my daughter. So I don't like the harshness of this. But most of all, what I really don't like, and every commentator will point this out, is that this is very Saul-centered. Cursed is the man who eats any food before I have taken vengeance on my enemies. Whose enemies are they? Well, now they're Saul's enemies. Who's going to defeat them? Saul is going to. So when the mission starts to belong to us, we're in big trouble. Our vision has gotten very blurry at that point. And this is far from the Saul of chapter 11, who said, "Not a man shall be put to death this day, for today the Lord has accomplished salvation in Israel." Okay, I want to summarize the next handful of events from chapter 14. You remember Jonathan then went and violated the oath unawares. He didn't know. He found some honey on the ground, dipped his staff in it, ate some. Everyone else chased the Philistines all day without eating, and they are near collapse. And when they start slaughtering and cooking the animals, the people rush to eat them before the blood was properly drained out of them, which upsets Saul. And he scolds them and corrects the situation. This is good. Saul did maintain a level of godliness. Or maybe we should say a form of godliness. He never just totally became abandon the commandments. Okay, and then Saul built an altar, maybe as an effort to make up for the sin of the people. And then Saul announces his plans to chase the Philistines all night. Let's go chase the Philistines. And the people say, "Okay, whatever you say." And the priests suggest, and I really wish Saul had made the suggestion, the priest has to suggest, "Let's ask God what we should do here." And then when they seek God for direction, he is silent. He does not answer. And Saul calls for a lot. Let's find out who has sinned. Why isn't God talking? Let's find out who has sinned. And he makes another oath. I think this is number two. It's kind of hard to keep track. He makes quite a few oaths in this chapter. He makes another oath. Whoever it is will die, even if it's my son Jonathan. And we know what happened. Jonathan is selected. And we can wonder, why did God even do this? Why did God refuse to answer and then have Jonathan selected as though Jonathan was guilty of some kind of sin, even though Jonathan was obviously the hero of the day? Why did God do that? And I think the reason he did it was not because God was upset at Jonathan, but this was his way of rebuking Saul for his rash oath and terrible judgment. In this whole story, Saul is the one who looks guilty. But I want you to notice how Saul reacts when Jonathan is chosen as the guilty one. Saul asked him, "What did you do, you guilty man?" And Jonathan told him and said, "I only tasted a little honey with the end of the rod that was in my hand, so now I must die." Saul answered, "God do so and more also, for you shall surely die, Jonathan." And the people had to rescue Jonathan from Saul. Now, Jonathan was the hero of this chapter. Of anyone present, he was the one most used by God. But when Jonathan is chosen as guilty, Saul's reaction is disturbing. There's no expression of grief. There's no hesitation. There's no appeal to God. He just comes out with another oath. "You shall surely die, Jonathan." It almost sounds savage. So that's where we're going to stop in the story of Saul here in chapter 14. And I want us to kind of recap what happened to him. He started off pretty well. He was a farmer, not obsessed with the throne. He seemed to be meek and humble. He recognized God as Israel's deliverer. He seemed to be small in his own eyes. But by the end of chapter 14, he's way off track. He set aside God's instructions for his own. He doesn't have time for God's guidance. He's being rough with people, including his own son. He's starting to talk like the mission belongs to him. And the rest of his life story just carries on this theme. He disobeys God again in chapter 15. And this time he builds himself a monument. And he loves David at first until he hears the song about David's 10,000s. And then he wants to kill him. And he's so blind in his pursuit of David that he has the priests of Nob murdered on suspicion of helping David. Saul even tries to kill Jonathan at one point. So what happened to Saul? And I think what happened was vision loss. I think it's a problem of vision. 1 Samuel 15:17, Samuel said, "When you were little in your own eyes, were you not head of the tribes of Israel? And did not the Lord anoint you king over Israel?" Like, once you were little in your own eyes, but you've lost that. Now he's big in his own eyes. And his service has shifted from being God-centered to becoming Saul-centered. Now, here are a few thoughts for us, applications for us. The lesson from Saul, and this is not just for leaders, it's for all Christians. The lesson is, if we lose our vision of God's greatness and our smallness, we will lose our sense of direction, and we will end up being far from where God wants us to be. And people around us will suffer, but we will suffer the most because we will lose fulfillment, we will lose joy, we will lose having God as our refuge. Saul was a miserable man at the end of it all. So we don't want to lose our vision. Here are some Saul-like symptoms I've picked out for vision loss that we should watch out for. Here's a symptom that we maybe are losing our vision. One would be when we compromise our obedience to God, like Saul did, and make excuses for it. Does God really care if I watch that borderline movie or play that video game? Does God really care if I share this gossip? Does God actually care if I don't report this income on my tax return? But you know what God notices? Is he notices when people don't really care. And this can be a symptom of vision loss. Do we see God as great and holy and awesome? For making compromises, maybe we don't. Here's another symptom. It's when the vision starts to become our vision, starts to belong to us, it becomes about us. It can be as small as of a thing as getting your family to church on time. Sometimes that can become more about me than it is about God and serving God. We should be concerned about what people think about us, and we should be concerned about being a good example, but too much of that can be a symptom of vision loss. Maybe too much concern about our role in the mission, that can be a symptom too. People didn't like my idea. People didn't put me on the committee. We can get offended. But whose mission is it? Church life can be frustrating. But whose mission is it? Another symptom of vision loss is when we're harsh with people around us. Shape up. Get in the car or you're going to be sorry. When we're rough with people, we've lost our vision for who owns the mission and what his priorities are. Another symptom of vision loss is when we don't have time for God himself. We don't seek his direction. We don't tell him about our struggles. We don't sit still in silence. and worship him. That can mean we've lost our vision for his majestic goodness and our weakness. So this morning I want us to be on guard to protect our vision of God and ourselves. And maybe the best way to do that is to keep looking at Jesus himself, keep our eyes fixed on him. He was the most un-Saul-like person ever. Jesus was so different from Saul. He said things like this: "Neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more. I have compassion on the multitude because they have now continued with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. Father, if it is your will, take this cup away from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd gives his life for the sheep." So this morning, one of the things I was thinking about as I was studying Saul was, I am so glad that I don't have to be one of Saul's servants. I mean, can you imagine serving a man like Saul? That'd be terrible. So I'm glad we don't have Saul for a king. That would be terrible. But the real danger here is not having him for a king. It's having ourselves for a king, which would be just as bad. So let's keep our eyes on Jesus. Let's maintain a clear vision of him being the king and the master, and we are his servants. God bless you.